is there are a number of research efforts, and they have gone on the record as describing the amount of money that they've spent for caribou conservation. What it appears, though, from just looking at the data in terms of population numbers, that that hasn't been sufficient. So they have made some economic sacrifices, but it appears that something more would have to happen to get to self-sustaining levels of caribou herds.
Both the federal and provincial species at risk legislation requires that action plans for species recovery be created for any species designated as threatened or endangered.
Once the species is identified as threatened or endangered, then an action plan must occur of some kind. A number of different strategies have to be developed and put on the landscape. Something has to be done. The minister can take into account social and economic implications of the action plan as part of the determination of the action plan.
Do you find the community is prepared to face the kinds of costs that saving a species such as the woodland caribou would cost?
We're just starting on this research, so we've had a few small group discussions with members of the public. And of course, what you find is that people are different, and some people feel that it's very important to invest and conserve, and some people don't feel it's so important. But I would say in general, we're getting a sense that this is an important species. It's a kind of iconic or charismatic species for Canadians, and they're quite concerned that the species is in decline and feel strongly that something should be done. We'll find out as we continue to engage in this research exactly what the public thinks about how much effort should be put into caribou conservation and what kind of funds we should invest in caribou conservation.
We've been talking about caribou economics, how much it costs to conserve caribou, and how it can be achieved with the least pain to taxpayers. For a final word, here is University of Alberta economist Vic Adamowicz once again.
Working with government agencies and with industry agencies, I think what people want to do is actually make some headway in identifying strategies that are well-defined and that people then have clarity about what actions should be taken or not taken. I think the uncertainty is what really troubles people, is not knowing what steps they are supposed to take or what's going to happen down the road. I think clarifying the issue and just saying this is the strategy we're going to undertake, I think that will help everybody.
Vic Adamowicz, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Dana. That wraps up another episode of Terra Informa. If you're just joining us, then unfortunately you've missed our show. But did you know that you can listen to every Terra Informa episode on our website? Just visit us at www.terrainforma.ca, and you can ensure that you're up to speed on everything that's happened on our show this week. I've been your host, Andy Reid. Please join us again next week on your local community radio station.
And now, wings.
It's like we're saying, oh, well, I guess we'll find another planet full of water. This is not sane.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. March 22nd is World Water Day. Article 31 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights reads, "Everyone has the right to clean and accessible water, adequate for the health and well-being of the individual and family, and no one shall be deprived of such access or quality of water due to individual economic circumstance." For her tireless work for the right to water, Canadian Maud Barlow was the UN's first senior advisor on water issues from 2008 to 2009. In an interview with Sue Supriano, Barlow explains why there are problems with the right to water.
Hi, everybody. Maud is an incredible woman, and she's a national chairperson of the Council of Canadians, a director with the International Forum on Globalization, which is a San Francisco-based research and education institution opposed to economic globalization. She's co-founder of the Blue Planet Project, an international movement to stop the commodification of water, and the best-selling author or co-author of 14 books, including Blue Gold, the battle to stop corporate theft of the world's water. And that's what we're going to be concentrating on here. We met Maud at protests against the Asian Development Bank a few years ago in Hawaii, and you've just been nonstop doing anti-globalization work and work on this water issue. So, as I say, I'm really thrilled to be able to talk to you. Welcome.
Thank you. Delighted to be here, Sue.
Let's just start talking about what's on top for you, which is the water issue, and needs to be on top for all of us, and that is one of the many, many issues that people are just not getting how serious it is. So lay it out for us.
Well, I guess what I always try to tell people is that there are kind of two things to know right now. One is the nature of the crisis, and it really is a crisis. We are not just polluting water, which is bad enough in itself, and we're not just distributing it desperately and equitably so that every 8 seconds a child dies of waterborne disease in the world, but we're running out. We are actually using up the finite, small amount of available fresh water at an absolutely alarming rate. We're depleting it, we're polluting it, we're diverting it. We're now mining the aquifers, we're destroying the water tables underneath the ground because we're letting salt water in, we're letting mining tailings in. We're, one way and another, we're just making, taking a resource that was we were all taught in school can never go away because it's in a closed hydrologic system. And we're actually depleting it. It's true it's not going away, but it's being converted from usable water to non-usable water. And we're adding many, many people to the planet at the same time. Well, that's one sort of stream I want to sort of get into people's heads. And there are now hotspots around the world that are actually either on the brink of running out of water or within the next 20, 30 years. Then on the other side, there is the dominant ideology of our time, which has, you know, been termed the Washington Consensus, which is basically that, you know, governments have to be as small and as possible and basically serve their business community interests, and they have to get out of the way in terms of social programs and resource stewardship and let the marketplace take over. And so everywhere, governments are abandoning their water services and their responsibility to their people, to water as a human right. And a handful of transnational companies is coming in and taking over the delivery of water services, particularly all through the third world, promoted by the World Bank, promoted by the big international agencies and Asia Development Bank and the Bank of the Americas and so on. And we also have bottled water that's happening very, very fast, in which most of us are complicit, not just the big corporations. We're looking at the potential mass movement of bulk water for commercial purposes by pipeline diversion or big ships, tanks, and so on. So all of a sudden, we're on the cusp of a move to privatize, commodify the world's dwindling fresh water supplies, because there are interests out there who know that it's the blue, what I call the blue gold of the 21st century. It's going to be, or is now, the most precious commodity, and whoever controls it will have a great deal of power. So I spent a great deal of my waking life trying to tell people this and working with groups and communities in my country and around the world to take back water, for communities to start taking ownership of it again, and to start to take the steps that we have to take to reclaim polluted waters so that when we do take it back, there is water there for us and other species and the earth and future generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, needless to say, we can't live without water. That is even more important than food, if we can even separate those things. And, of course, it's very easy for people not to feel this. And the United States are in real industrialized countries because they turn the tap and there it is, actually.
Well, we've become separated from nature. And I don't think there's any better example than water. I mean, every ancient religion, every First Nations people, all of us in very, very short time ago lived a life in connection with water because you had to. When we industrialized and when we set up these huge cities, and then those huge cities had those huge sewage water delivery and water sewage systems, we got one step even further divorced from, you know, the local lake that you have to keep clean or you won't have water to drink, or the local river, or catching rain in a rain barrel, or digging a small well in your property and taking the water. We've become so removed from that that we just think it's endless. There'll always be clean water. It's very inexpensive, and we can just use whatever we want and never worry about it. And we all learned in school that there's a closed hydrologic cycle, and so where could that water go anyway? way. Well, it's not that, and this is really what's so important to know, it's not that there's less water in the world than there was. It's whether that water is available to us to use. When you convert it to seawater by having too much urbanization, so when it rains, it's like the rain falling on a big cement umbrella that's going into the ocean. So too much of what should be coming back to us as non-salinated water is being converted to seawater. And that's actually been quantified in a study by a group of scientists in Slovakia. So, I mean, you're actually taking usable, potable water and rendering it unusable.
I hadn't heard about this.
Oh, this is very important. We're actually decreasing the amount of fresh water in the hydrologic cycle, because if water evaporates from a meadow or a forest or, you know, over, sorry, a stream or a lake, it should fall back to meadows and forests and so on. It should be some amount of reciprocity, if you will. But if we pave and pave and pave and we don't leave green places for the water to come back to so that it seeps down to replenish the groundwater that we're also taking up too fast, it's like falling on a cement umbrella. And it goes into the oceans. Drains drain into oceans, or they drain into polluted water. So you're taking fresh rainwater, and instead of going back, as I say, into meadows and fields, even parks, even if you just leave lots of park space, then it trickles down into the aquifers and back into the groundwater, and then you can use it again. It's like hitting a great big cement umbrella. And so we're not recapturing that water, and that's one of the reasons the oceans are rising. It's not just global warming. And this is very, very important. And only very recently begun to be explored by scientists. We also have other ways that we destroy existing water. If you have a big aquifer and you've done careless drilling near it, and you've allowed seawater to come in, and then seawater contaminates the pure water, well, you've still got the water in that aquifer, but it's all salinated now. Or if you've got a mine, with mercury or some other kind of chemical pollution or runoff, and that gets into the aquifer, then that can destroy it. We have chemicals in our world, one called MTBE that's used in California that's made by a Canadian company, of course, and the Canadian company's using a NAFTA challenge to try to get California not to ban it. But just several drops of it can destroy an entire lake, can destroy an entire aquifer, and it's used as a gasoline additive.
We do use it in California, because
Yes, you do, and you've been there has been talk of banning it, and there's a NAFTA challenge if you do try to go ahead and ban it.
Since 2003, when this interview took place, the gasoline additive MTBE has been banned in half the states of the U.S., including California. Environment Canada still permits its production and use, but companies are suspected to be phasing it out. MTBE is only one, however, of many sources of chemical pollution. Maud Barlow.
So these are the kinds of things that in small amounts can destroy a whole water table. So you still have the same amount of liquid water in the world, but it's not usable, it's not accessible. And this is what people have to get, is that we live so disconnected from water that we put billions and billions of gallons every single year of it into plastic bottles that are ending up in huge, huge dumps. A lot of them are going to the Philippines. That's the new growth industry in the Philippines, are these mountains, I'm not kidding you, mountains of plastic water bottles from all over the world that are being shipped there. And they do, you know, they do some sorting and some recycling, or that's the argument. But of course, most of them end up in wetlands and forests and in the ocean. I mean, people diving in the ocean now say there's nowhere you can go to get away from water bottles. They're everywhere. So we've disconnected. We don't understand that we are water, as David Suzuki said in his talk. We are water. We are air. We are nature. We are the environment. We've separated ourselves. And we also have this notion in our consumer society, especially in North America, that whatever we run out of, we'll just go somewhere else and buy. So the cod are gone off the East Coast. Well, hell, let's go to Chile and take their sea bass. Oops, the sea bass are all gone. Well, let's see what's lower down. Or I heard there's a new fish stock that they found off some country in Africa. We have this notion that you'll never run out. Well, we are running out. We're running out of fresh water. We're running out of the big fish in the ocean, running out a lot of the small fish, too. So these things are finite. These things are not infinite, and particularly water. So first and most important thing we have to do is change our relationship to water. Water I've been known to chase after people who've taken one sip from a big bottle of water, Perrier or whatever, and say, excuse me, you didn't finish your water, you know, because it's been in an aquifer for 100,000 years, and you took one sip, and you're going to let it be thrown out, enjoy and be put in the sewage, you know. So when you start to see it differently, then that's the first step to doing what we have to do.
Yeah. And I remember in California when we had a drought 15 years ago or something, and people stopped flushing the toilet so much and started paying attention to water in restaurants and all kinds of things. And now, no consciousness about it. They just don't pay any attention all over again.
I think that part of our problem is people can't believe what people like me are saying, so it's got to be a drought. I was just in New Mexico a couple of months ago. And, I mean, New Mexico's running out of water. They've only got 10 years. Arizona's already out of water. They're buying it from the Columbia River. And yet they're putting up golf courses and great big monster homes with great big swimming pools in the backyard. Like, I mean, this is not sane. It's like we're saying, oh, well, I guess we'll find another planet full of water. Where do they think it's going to come from? It's not going to come from anywhere, except if you're going to bring it in by mass diversion from a place like Canada, which is going to have enormous environmental implications.
Canada, Maud Barlow's home country, still does not have legally enforceable drinking water standards. Canada is losing much of its fresh water due both to pollution and the disappearance of glaciers. Public pressure is still the only block to bulk water exports out of Canada.
Golf courses are one of the biggest water wasters, right?
Golf courses around the world are a very controversial issue. What's happening, and this is very connected to water, is that the prime land everywhere, whether it's oceanfront, lakefront, golf course, the best greens, are being taken up for the world's wealthy. I mean, we really have class stratified in the world. And the wealthy have the money to travel wherever they want and go to whatever golf courses they want and go to whatever resorts they want. And, of course, they're served by the local people. And one of the things that we've documented is in many, many cases, the golf courses get all the water they need in a drought, or even if it's just permanent drought, permanent water scarcity, while the people have to go scrambling for their water. And we had one conference where we confronted some of the World Bank and the water barons, I call them. And there was a man from Cancun, Mexico, who works in one of the 5-star hotels and then lives in a poor area of the city. And it's all serviced by the Suez, this private company. And he held up 2 bottles of water. One was clear. And he said, that's from the tap in the 5-star hotel I work in. And the other looked like Coca-Cola. It was muddy, awful, stunk. And he said, this is what comes out of my tap. And this is all served by the same private water company, all presumably coming from some similar kind of source. Very, very powerful statement. He said this to a bunch of CEOs, and he sent the water up to challenge the CEO of Suez, the company that's implemented this privatization, to challenge the guy, are you going to, you know, will you open it and smell it? So this is what we're dealing with now. We see water in many ways as the most obvious example of class bias in the world. Who has it? Who has the right to it? And who doesn't? You know, you will know by your lifestyle whether you're part of the elite. If you can turn around and buy as many bottles of water as you want and never think about it, then you're part of the world's water elite. Whether you've got clean water in your own life or not, you're still a water elite. For most people in the world, that option just isn't there.
Really? And I noticed that people where I live, in Berkeley, California, everybody drinks bottled water, and I think we're supposed to have the cleanest, including myself. I grew up with a well, and I've never liked city water, but I use the same bottle at least over and over. But I'm not sure why people even do that. It's just part of the culture.
Well, first of all, it's considered cool to have your... It's so healthy. It's a sign of health. And, of course, you've heard the 8x8. You have to have 8 glasses of water, you know, they say 7 days a week. And, of course, that's been traced to the water companies. Talk to a doctor, and they'll tell you that you can drink too much water, actually. You know, for certain people, they can actually go into a coma, but you mustn't drink more water than your body requires. So people who force themselves to drink water, it has to be ancient water, some kind of a bottle that looks fancy and has to have a fancy label. You know, you're probably just as safe with your local tap water. Certainly New York City, some of the finest water in the world. Now, I'm not saying if you go to Mexico City or Guatemala or South Africa or wherever, where the systems have been allowed to deteriorate so badly that you should not drink bottled water. But it's a form of mass insanity for us to allow our public water systems to deteriorate or to think they've deteriorated when they haven't. And that big, important study done 2 years ago by the National Resource Defense people found that over a third of all bottled water is less safe than your tap water.
My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm speaking with Maud Barlow, chairperson of the Council of Canadians, co-founder of the Blue Planet Project to Stop the Commodification of Water, and the best-selling author or co-author of 14 books, including Blue Gold, The Battle to Stop Corporate Theft of the World's Water. Maud Barlow, tell us some about some other countries. You were telling, I want to let people know, too, that we're at the Bioneers Conference. This is a yearly conference, and you spoke this morning, and you told some stories about some things in other countries, South Africa, and some work that you do, and I'm sure with all your travels and all your anti-globalization work, you have a lot of stories. So if you would share some of those.
Well, South Africa is an incredible one because South Africa gained the right to water as a human right in the Constitution when apartheid was defeated. First country in the world to do this. So people were very excited. And, you know, if you've ever visited the townships, you know they're huge, sprawling, massive areas of poverty. I mean, you'll, as far as the eye can see, you'll be seeing poverty, little hovels, little corrugated tin, I wouldn't even call them a house, really. Pit latrines outside, no running water, rats in the gutter, burning tires. I mean, just devastating poverty. But finally, they are bringing water up to people's doors. With a pipe, one pipe, you know, with one water source per house and a water tap. But they've installed state-of-the-art, high-technology, impregnable water meters. And so you have to pay for every single drop of water that you take. And people are, you know, they can't afford it. You know, I remember standing in one of these communities and just thinking, this gives new meaning to the concept, water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink, you know. But people are fighting back. They're undoing the technology. Some of the same workers that have to put those meters in the day come back and teach people how to dismantle them at night. So it's a very subversive kind of thing going on. Bolivia, there was a water war. There's a war now almost going on around gas. The Bolivians are adamant that they're not going to, you know, not going to allow their resources to be sold for profit for, you know, a small elite at the top of their system. But they were forced by the World Bank to privatize water a few years ago, and there was a civil war that ensued. The water prices were raised, doubled overnight, in some cases tripled, and people just couldn't access it. And they said, well, I'd rather take a chance being shot in the street than not have any water to drink. So it's very powerful stuff that's happening. And in the case of, oh my goodness, in Montevideo, Uruguay, they're fighting to bring in a national referendum against the water privatization. Buenos Aires, they've kicked it out. Manila, the Philippines, the company's been kicked out. Atlanta, Georgia, Suez, which is supposed to have a 20-year contract, was kicked out after only 2 years. The mayor said, get out, don't come back. You know, we want our water system back. Quite a conservative mayor, I understand. So there is a huge fight back taking place in communities around the world. And when I travel to places that have good water systems like Japan, they're talking about privatizing just because of the ideology. And, you know, one of the stories that I'm trying to communicate to people is don't give away your right to water. Don't give it away now. You'll have such a fight trying to get it back.
These water revolts Maud Barlow described in 2003 have actually brought changes. Uruguay nationalized its private water services due to petitions and public pressure, and against the will of the World Bank. In Bolivia, the water uprising was a major factor in bringing in a new government that included the right to water in its national charter. In Soweto, South Africa, people are now entitled to a certain amount of free water before they have to start paying for what comes out of the tap. They are seeking to raise the water allowance to cover all basic needs. Maud Barlow.
And I do want to say, because of what your radio program is about and your concerns, that this is also very deeply connected to the issue of peace, not just through the concept of justice and how many who has water and who doesn't and the the inequity that breeds the violence that we all know about, but also the issue of wars between communities and eventually between countries as the water of our world dwindles. I think you're going to even see it between states in the United States. And the antidote could be, of course, that water could be the source of peace. I often think of those comet movies, you know, the Hollywood movies with the comet coming towards the Earth, and suddenly all our differences kind of pale. Religious, cultural, ancient differences just suddenly don't matter because we're all either going to die of this comet or somehow we'll send Tom Cruise or somebody up and blow the comet up, right? Well, I think the comet's here. I think it's called the world's freshwater crisis. And I think if we don't find a way to get our act together, it really will deteriorate into those who have it or those who are gaining control of it will have enormous power. And people will die, and people will fight over it. There will be wars over water.
You were talking about privatization. There are corporations, and I would like to hear the names of those corporations because they are specific, which you know better than I. And already there are places where there isn't water. So if in our little time left, and we have a little bit of time still, if you would talk about some of the specifics of that, Maud Barlow.
Well, the three biggest water corporations in terms of the privatization of municipal water services are all European. One is called Vivendi, and people hear about Vivendi, they think of the entertainment side, but Vivendi actually made its original money from water. And Suez, which is another, same folks that built the Suez Canal. And the third is a big new merged one called RWE Thames. It was German. RWE in Germany merged with Thames in Great Britain. Now, there are others around, but most of the ones, even the ones that you'll hear as an American company, are actually subsidiaries of one of these three big conglomerates. And there was a big Enron subsidiary called Azurix. And it was going to enter the water world big time, but when Enron went down, thankfully so did Zurich. These three big corporations, big water companies, are among the top 100 corporations in the world. They're all very, very wealthy, growing very fast. Vivendi has 300,000 employees in its water divisions worldwide. So, I mean, we're talking about huge companies growing at about 10% a year. They are working very closely with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, who are promoting them dramatically to the third world. And so people there are told, if you want help with your delivery of water, your people are dying, you have to take Suez, or they divide the world up, or you'll take Vivendi, you'll take Suez. And that public money, which is what the World Bank has, is being used to promote and enforce, in fact, water privatization. The World Bank has just announced that it's going to increase its funding for privatization from $1.3 billion a year to $4 billion a year. And that's because there have been so many fights on the ground around the world because people are so angry with their water being stolen from them, I call it water theft, that they're just turning around saying no.
In 2008, during Water Week in Washington, World Bank Vice President Kathy Sierra went so far as to say that privatization is not the only answer. However, a February 2011 posting on the bank's website says, "Water is a private good," and opposes government subsidy for providing clean water. Maud Barlow.
On the bottled water side, there are really three big corporations. There's Nestle, which owns just about everybody you can think of. It's Poland Springs, it owns Perrier, it owns Naya, it owns everybody. As soon as a water company gets big enough, Nestle comes in and takes it over. And there are big fights here in the United States, up in Wisconsin and Michigan, around the Great Lakes, with bottled water takings for Nestle and Perrier. Then you get Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, which come in and take municipal water sources, and they destroy, for every liter or gallon that they use, they destroy twice as much from their reverse osmosis process. And they just get huge contracts to come up and just put their pipe, you know, put their cups under our municipal water supply. And so when a community or city suddenly finds its water level, its water table dropping dramatically, sometimes they don't even know it's because your city council was trapped for money and they just did a deal with Coca-Cola. Coke says that its water bottling arm will overtake its Classic Coke and Diet Coke and all of that within a few years. Coke already says that they are now responsible for 10% of the TLI, which is total liquid intake of the world, and they want to raise that to 25%. They know they've got their goal. They want to supply you with everything liquid you take into your body, from water to juice to, you know, their Coca-Cola. So we have these very aggressive bottled water companies, and they're going into the third world and actually getting the right to whole water systems. Coca-Cola was given access and a 100-year contract to an entire water system in Kerala, India. And the local people have lost their right to use their water, to use it for drinking, to use it for farming. I mean, it's just an appalling situation. But you get desperate third world governments combined with thirsty, rich first world people and big companies that want to come in and take the last of the water. I call them water hunters. And we have to say no. We're on the cusp of this thing. We can turn it around if we work together, and we have to do it.
In another update, just on February 24, 2011, the Kerala State Assembly passed a bill setting up a special tribunal to assess compensation against Coca-Cola for losses its plant had caused to people due to pollution and over-extraction of water, in violation of environmental laws.